Then we're moving on to our own Johanna Kanteria, who is a postdoctoral fellow on the Verlet Internationalist Project and works on medical, environmental, urban history of the Soviet Union, looking in particular at the sort of idea of Soviet sanatoria and how they developed. And I think we're in for an interdisciplinary.
Yes. Thank you, Anna. So when I was thinking about what to present today, I do work in public health with medicine as well, but I'm also looking at urban planning from a medical and public health perspective. And really for today, to fit this conference, I thought I would work on the urban planners. And we're moving chronologically forward now, although we're talking also about that same question that already comes up in the 1936 question of abortion. I mean, one of the justifications was that the standard of living was rising, and so women were no longer needing to turn to abortion because that would be the reason they would turn to it, because they were suffering. So we're continuing that narrative of Soviet models of prosperity and the ways in which the Soviet model raised standards of living, and the way in which the Soviets presented this case of prosperity from planning in international settings. And specifically to the 1958 Congress of the International Architectural Union, which took place in Moscow. So this international meeting was actually the first meeting of architects in that the Soviets participated in since the Stalin xenophobic period of the post-war. The premier, Nikita Khrushchev, specifically endorsed this meeting and met formally with 20 of the most prominent delegates to the Congress. And beyond this high-profile meeting, this Congress also offered all sorts of opportunities for informal exchange. 1,500 architects went to this conference from 44 countries. Those are in the Eastern Bloc, in the Western Bloc, and really from a global reach. From the West, the United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, Portugal, Belgium, Sweden, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and West Germany sent delegates. From the East, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, and then also from Argentina, Venezuela. I'm giving a fairly long list, but you'll see it really has a global aspect. Venezuela, Chile, Mexico, China, Vietnam, Japan, Israel, Morocco, and Tunisia. So these are some of the dimensions of this meeting. So really this was a showcase for two styles, two models of development that was being presented not only in a competition of East and West, but also a competition for the hearts and minds of the South. So many Soviets came to this conference in Moscow to attend, and they encountered for the first time professionals from abroad. But they didn't only encounter professionals from abroad from the West, but they also encountered professionals from the East for the first time in many cases. And in fact, the Congress in Moscow in 1958 fits into a broader context of an opening of the Soviet Union to the West that really characterized the Khrushchev period and the period of the thaw. And this is, if you know this historiography, there's a great deal of interest in the World Youth Congresses of this period as well. I see this as sort of a World Congress, Youth Congress of architects. It was a real celebration of openness. So this Congress took place in Moscow in the years of the first U.S.-Soviet formal cultural exchanges of the Cold War period, the Lacy-Zarubin Agreement. The exchange was the most substantial formal outcome of the Geneva Summit of 1955. Here, I'll just take a straight out of my teaching materials. But Geneva Summit of 1955 with the leaders of the U.S., France, Great Britain, and the USSR. So the real reason for this Congress was to decide on the questions of disarmament and the fate of Germany. These were the formal discussion points. But it was the first summit since Potsdam. And it was, in fact, a meeting where all sides were very anxious about basic questions of whether the other side was pursuing peace or whether there would be a great deal of tensions. And this is also the first summit after the death of Stalin. So actually the Soviet side was very, very nervous about how they would present themselves. So although they failed to come to any formal agreement on the formal points of discussion, they both did decide that friendship was the way forward. And President Eisenhower famously announced that the people of the United States should become friends with the people of the Soviet Union. So after a few years of negotiation, the Lacy-Zarubin Agreement was signed in 1958. it was a mandate that exchanged that called for all kinds of exchanges of artists and writers, scientists, scholars, students, youth groups, and athletes. And it was also a turning point where Soviet membership in international professional organizations, too, increased a great deal. While both sides endeavored to shape the cultural exchanges to their own ends, the very fact of these exchanges, these cultural exchanges, has been credited by scholars to have stimulated a peaceful competition over standards of living as opposed to a military conflict. And so this competition became shifted to a question of civilizations, of standards of living, and of prosperity. But as I would like to point out in this paper, and really the argument of my paper today, is that this opening of the USSR to the West coincided with another major opening in international exchange, which also characterized this period, that between experts within the socialist world. So while earlier depictions of relations between experts within the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc focus mainly on coercion, new work has emphasized a really multivalent nature of socialist exchanges. And based on the study of urban design, especially Elidor Miocheli's work, he has argued that post-war periods saw burgeoning exchanges in knowledge, technology, and planning instruments among socialist countries. Miocheli points to the participation of Eastern Bloc experts in the forging of an urban design within the Eastern Bloc, which unfolded through an ongoing process of exchange, so not really merely the imposition of a model from the Soviets into the Eastern Bloc. So the projects of East-West cultural diplomacy, which we are used to seeing these international congresses in the context of, were also a context of socialist institution building. And while we tend to see these two processes as separate in this historiography, I want to challenge that distinction that we make as something that is somewhat synthetic. The rigid separation of the process of socialist institution building and Cold War exchange structures has characterized each, but in practice there was a fluid relationship between socialist contacts and East-West contacts in these international congresses and meetings, and the projects of Cold War and socialist world institution building overlapped, intersected, and developed together and in dialogue. So I argue that in this paper that Soviet participation in international organizations, which so characterized its opening to the West in this period, also had increased importance an increased importance of cultural diplomacy between systems of the Khrushchev period, not only served to create connections between the two world systems, but also forged new and strengthened existing ties within the socialist world. And by shifting the historical focus from the perspective of foreign relations and high politics, in fact, to the perspective of the experts themselves, the Moscow architect who's meeting for the first time foreigners from Romania as well as from West Germany, by shifting our focus to the perspective of the experts themselves, this distinction between the two projects of socialist institution building and Cold War institutions of exchange really can be called into question. So in this paper, and I'm not going to give the whole paper now, I'll just discuss a few of the points that I make, drawing on a close reading of Soviet architectural journals and a stenographic report of the 1958 Congress. I demonstrate that actually at the Congress, this particular Congress was really instrumental in awakening Soviet interest in Bulgarian and Romanian architecture in particular, and led to the forging of lasting ties between Soviet, Romanian, and Bulgarian architects, and the creation of what I describe elsewhere as a commonly held zone of peace and friendship of the peoples around the Black Sea, creating in the Black Sea literal a sort of collectively held health resort. Soviet architects' new contacts with the world, particularly their immediate Eastern Bloc colleagues, had consequences in Soviet design and building, including the discovery of this shared Black Sea project of expanding access to health resort infrastructure. Let's see. So now to back up to talking about the context of this Congress, the International Union of Architects was founded, it is a Western organization. And my second argument for this paper is that the evidence presented here suggests that this Congress, while it was designed in the West as an instrument with which to undermine the socialist way of life by demonstrating Western superiority, had in fact an unintended consequence of strengthening ties between socialist countries. So the institution was founded as a Western organization fitting into a political landscape of the Cold War alongside the Congress for Cultural Freedom, for example, as an apparatus of struggle coordinated by the West for the minds of post-war Europe. It was a consciously non-polemical international organization of architects. Unlike the radical international modernist organization, the International Congress of Modern Architecture, the UIA had no explicit position for or against modernism, which still smacked of socialism in this period. Because it focused rather on the advancement of the professional status of architects, the UIA was more amenable to cultural diplomacy agendas. And at the fourth Congress of the UIA held in 1955 in The Hague, the Congress passed a resolution, in fact, making the intention of the organization clear that it was to attract members from socialist countries. The resolution aimed to unite architects beyond limits of race, nationality, political and ideological opinions, accepting countries from the socialist bloc as UIA members. And this was not merely a benign friendship organization, but it was one advocating peaceful connections, but one that was meant to showcase Western superiority. The 1958 UIA Congress in Moscow was really a very early Cold War competition over living standards. Here, it was for the first time an American kitchen, for example, was put on display in an exhibition that was organized by the American Institute of Architects at Moscow State University. This was a full year between the famous kitchen debates and the second kitchen, as I found, that was opened at the American Exhibition in Moscow. So the first kitchen had an 82-panel photographic display of what was most typical in U.S. architecture. And it was the first exhibit of U.S. building in the USSR since World War II. And I should mention that the theme of this Congress was actually post-war reconstruction. As Time magazine reported, the exhibit drew some 4,000 visitors daily. It was largely focused on architecture for automobile transportation, based on the figure of 60 million cars in America, and included a display of Los Angeles expressways, multi-parking garages, and motels. So this was the American model. In his report describing the AIA exhibition, American architect Henry Churchill argued, quote, "It may be said that the major urban problem is to rebuild our cities so that there will be a place for both the automobile and for people." We're living with this legacy in the United States now. "It is to this problem that almost all our city planning experiments are addressed." The Soviet side also sought to present itself in the best possible light, while also using the Congress as a way to learn about new developments and technologies abroad, an ongoing factor driving Soviet participation in international exchanges. They also put up their own exhibition on the new Soviet urban planning tied to de-Stalinization, now some 4 years old. So this is really cutting-edge material that they're presenting here. It marked a really radical departure from the Stalinist past and also a tentative reconsideration of their own avant-garde Soviet heritage. In his report to the Congress, Nikolai Baranov, a fellow of the Construction and Architecture Academy of the USSR, made the Cold War context of the Congress as a competition over living standards explicit. He argued that Congress offered a showcase of two social systems, quote, "the capitalist system and the socialist system," and served as a forum for peaceful competition between these systems over living standards. Quote, "While working in entirely different social conditions, but guided by a single noble purpose, in the not too distant future, we, the rising generation, will be able to judge who has attained the greatest success in providing for the needs of the urban population." The significant presence at the Congress of architects from the third world meant that this competition also had global dimensions. And here the contrast with the parking and car focus of the Americans was made explicit. Karo Alabian, a leading Soviet architect of the Stalin era, argued to the Congress, quote, "Housing is the most important social problem facing society today." In analyzing reports presented at the UIA Congress, it also becomes clear that Soviet architects and architects from other socialist countries were learning a great deal about developments in each other's countries as well. Indeed, most of the reports presented to the Congress were based on a close analysis of UIA questionnaires themselves that were filled out by all participating countries, including the socialist countries. These questionnaires were an important mechanism for the initial exchange of information at the Congress, both within the socialist world and between systems. For example, in his report, Lyuben Tonyev, head of the Town Planning Institute of the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences, listed each question from the questionnaire in his report and analyzed the answers that were given within the socialist countries, pointing to both commonalities and major differences. Vyacheslav Shvarikov, the director of the Institute for Town Planning, in his report drew on information from questionnaires as well. In fact, the majority of reports made to the Congress were prepared almost exclusively on the basis of the questionnaires, which I found quite surprising. And while reports from socialist architects were perhaps meant to demonstrate a unified front to the West, in practice, the reports actually highlighted the great differences in practices of urban planning and architecture in the socialist countries, going into great detail. But the whole point I am making here is that all reports at the Congress were based to some degree on an analysis of UIA questionnaires, which were an important mechanism of exchange of knowledge not only between East and West, but also within the socialist world. Also, there were differences in the questionnaire itself. There were two copies, one in French and one in Russian, and the questions were slightly different. The 1958 Congress marked an important turning point in Soviet architecture, as Soviet architects became increasingly aware of what made the socialist system different from the capitalist system in practice. And they were starting to work that out, in fact, in the Congress. It was also a turning point in Soviet relationships with architects in other socialist countries. Indeed, architects interacted simultaneously with Western and Eastern architects, as well as architects from the Third World, forging not only one set of contexts or the other, but all simultaneously. And after this Congress, the pages of the main journal of the Soviet Union of Architects, Architektura SSSR, started to cover extensively architecture and urban planning in the other socialist countries and sent many delegations abroad who came back with extensive reports. So as I describe in my paper, the period after the 1958 Congress saw a marked increase in interest in the Soviet Union, in particular in health resort developments on the Romanian and Bulgarian coasts of the Black Sea. And now I really do want to point out that in the context of this, in the paper, I talk a lot more about the relationship between Soviet ideas of urban planning and health. So this is really how it fits into our discussion as well. In conclusion, I have related domestic architectural policies to policies of the socialist world and to the Cold War, showing through the lens of the Black Sea how each scale of activity influenced and was interconnected with the other. Indeed, an aim of this paper is to blur the distinctions that are often made between these scales. The experience of UIA Soviet delegates calls into question the separation in the historical literature between the projects of the forging of the socialist world and the Cold War world. In practice, there was a fluid relationship between the socialist context and East-West context in international organizations, and the projects of Cold War and socialist world cultural diplomacy overlapped, intersected, and developed together and in dialogue. The historiography has reinforced what I see as an at times synthetic divide between the worlds socialist and capitalist. And the evidence presented here further suggests that the UIA Congresses, designed in the West as an instrument with which to undermine the socialist way of life, had the unintended consequence of strengthening ties between socialist countries.